Who are the real people we consider our sages? Who were they in life? What is the legacy they left us? Join Rabbi Danny Sackstein for the next hour as he explores the lives of our Torah giants, the spiritual geniuses who shaped the way we approach Judaism today. That's Focus on Our Sages right now on 101.9 Chai FM.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Soul to Soul. Great to be with you on this cool Wednesday afternoon. And what I want to do with you today, in the short time that we have together, is to look at the incredible events 80 years ago that happened on the 6th of June 1944, the D-Day landings. We haven't had a chance to talk about them up until now. But I'm wanting to take this opportunity. So we're a little bit after the 80th anniversary, which is on the 6th of June, 1944. And in fact, the Hebrew date of D-Day was the 15th of June, 1944, which is actually my Hebrew birthday, which was only this past Friday. So that brings us closer. But I wanted to talk about D-Day because it's very important to remember what happened. It's very important to appreciate what was done. And it's very important to learn the historical lessons that are very relevant to us today from what happened back then 80 years ago. So maybe we'll just mention to kick off from an introductory point of view that one of the great lessons we learned from World War II is that it's very important to stand up to dictators and to totalitarian countries, societies, because the longer we leave them, the bigger the monster gets. And when we don't stand up to their aggression and to the international appetite they have to dominate their region or to dominate the world, so they just get bolder and stronger, and the problem doesn't go away. And unfortunately, that's clearly what happened at the beginning of World War II, 90 years ago. So it's 91 years ago since Hitler came to power. And Hitler, he tested the waters, and he prodded and he pushed, and he wanted to see what the reaction would be from the Western democracies to his aggression. And he was not surprised at all to see that there was no reaction, that Hitler viewed the Western democracies as weak, as cowardice, as having no guts and no courage and no backbone. And Chamberlain, who was the Prime Minister of Britain, was the epitome of that, that Hitler saw that he could push him, and there would be no pushback in response. And that's what emboldened Hitler to join in to ally with Stalin. Stalin had the same view. They really saw the world in a similar way. And that's what gave Hitler the courage to rearm Germany and to have a very aggressive foreign policy and to start wars in Europe and to expand Germany for the Lebensraum that he spoke about in Mein Kampf. It was necessary for the great German people to have this area, this space, this living room for their thousand-year Reich. And if the Allies had stood up to the Western powers that stood up to Hitler earlier on, so that would have prevented the horrors of World War II, and it would have saved millions and millions of lives. And that's such a vital lesson for us to bear in mind, and it's so relevant to our times too, because in our world today, we also have these aggressors, these dictators, these megalomaniacs that want power and control. We're not short of them. We have Putin in Russia. We have President Xi from China. We have North Korea and Kim Jong-un from North Korea. Of course, we have the Ayatollahs in Iran. All of them they have totalitarian states. And they have power, and they want to expand their power. And unless that power is checked And unless there's firm leadership from the West, so they will be free to do as they wish. And as we've seen in the last number of years, that the world is pretty much on fire. And because there hasn't been a strong response to the aggression of these leaders, so there's a lot of unrest around the world. And unless you have a strong America who's prepared to stand up to this aggression with the might of the American military and of the American industrial power, so then these individuals will go unchecked and they will continue to push and continue to carry out their aggressive aspirations in their regions and in the world. So that's a very important lesson we learned from World War II. Unfortunately, the Allies were weak to start off with, and that emboldened Hitler, and that allowed him to carry out his aggression. And that led to the beginning of World War II. And then a massive effort was required in order to defeat him and in order to free the world from Nazi tyranny. So that's pretty much what D-Day was. D-Day was the middle of World War II. We have the Nazis in the early years of the war, 39, 40, 41, tremendous victories in Europe, where Germany takes over most of Europe. And Germany now are fighting their war with Russia. So in 1941, they attacked the Russians. And things have slowed down a little bit in 42. And already by winter 42, the turn is beginning. And the Wehrmacht are not enjoying the great and fast victories that they had in the early years of the war. So Stalin, and there's a bit of a stalemate between the Germans and the Russians in the east. And Stalin is pushing hard for his allies to open up a front on the west, a western front. And that obviously would be very difficult for Germany to deal with, because they now would have a two-front war. And that's why they lost World War I, and that's why they lost World War II. So Stalin is pushing hard for that. And the Russians are trying to stop the Germans, and they are experiencing tremendous losses and casualties of their soldiers, and they're trying to provide armaments and rearm themselves. And so the war is going at full throttle on the Eastern Front in 1942 and in 1943. And so Stalin is pushing hard that the Western Front should open immediately. And the Allies told him that they're not ready yet for such an operation, and they need to build up their forces and they need to plan the operation. So by the end of 1943, November 1943, we have the Tehran Conference, which is held between the Allies, and Roosevelt and Churchill and Stalin meet in Tehran, and they agree that they will open up the Western Front by May 1944. And so there's a lot of work to be done in order to ensure that that could be achieved. And so the first thing they have to do in order to be able to open this Western Front is appoint what they called a supreme commander. They needed somebody who would run the operation. The leader of the ground forces would be General Bernard Montgomery, the great British general. The leader of the Air Force would be Air Chief Marshal Lee Mallory. And the head of the naval forces would be Admiral Bertrand Ramsay. Now, all three of these were British. And since the majority of soldiers would be American, and the majority of the weapons would be coming and supplies would be coming from America, so it then made sense that the leader of the operation should be an American. And everybody thought that George Marshall, who was the chief of staff of the United States Army, would be appointed as the supreme commander of this operation, what's called SHAFE, which was Supreme Headquarters of the Allied Expeditionary Forces. But Roosevelt said that Marshall was indispensable, and he needed Marshall to be with him in the United States to conduct the war. And so they appointed one of the rising stars in the staff of the American military, of the generals, And that was in an individual by the name of Dwight David Eisenhower. Eisenhower he was 54 years old. He was born in 1890. He had qualified through West Point. He had commanded the operations in Northern Africa and in Italy. And so he was ideally suited to lead this operation. There was a bit of pushback from the British generals, and they told Churchill that that's too much power for one individual. And Eisenhower said to Churchill, well, either you give me command of the operation or you find somebody else. And so Churchill agreed. And Eisenhower was very smart. He realized that if he didn't have supreme command, so there would be egos and there would be so many opinions and so many critical decisions that needed to be made timelessly. And if there wasn't a single commander operating this mission, those decisions wouldn't be made, and it would affect the effectiveness and certainly the success of the operation. So Eisenhower is appointed as the supreme commander, and now he has to plan and arrange this incredible operation, which ended up with D-Day. Please stay with us. We'll be back in a moment.
This is Focus on Our Sages with Rabbi Danny Sackstein on 101.9 Chai FM.
We're talking about the 80th anniversary of D-Day, which is such a fascinating topic, and we're discussing the incredible events that led up to the spectacular and largest amphibious invasion in the history of the world. And the original plan was to find, firstly, what they had to find a commander of the Allies who would do it, and Dwight David Eisenhower was the individual chosen to be the supreme commander of this operation. Now, they had to then decide where the landings would take place. From as early as 1942, Hitler knew that there would be an attempt by the Allies to land their forces in Western Europe. And Hitler then built what was known as the Atlantic Wall, which was a massive wall of fortifications all the way from Northern Europe, which is Norway, from the north of Norway, right the way down to the south of France. It was spanned a distance of 2,687 kilometers. And the fortifications were formidable. While building these fortifications, they used 13 million tons of concrete, 1.5 million tons of steel. And so the idea was, Eisenhower said that, I actually heard an amazing interview, you can find it on YouTube, 20 years after D-Day, 1964, Eisenhower went with a film crew with Walter Cronkite and went back to the beaches and the significant places in Normandy and spoke about, you know, the incredible events of that operation. And he described how any commander understood that in order to land your forces for an amphibious invasion, one would need to secure a port, a deep water port, a conventional harbor. And so the Germans first and foremost fortified all of the harbors in Western Europe, all the way from Norway down to France. So that's Norway, Denmark, Germany, Netherlands, Belgium, France. And that massive distance of 2,687 kilometers. So all the deep water ports were very well protected and very well guarded by the Germans. They had massive guns, they had mines, they had big bunkers, and these what were called pillboxes. It was very, very difficult for the Allies to be able to conquer a port and take over a port. They tried. There was an operation in a place called Dieppe, which is in France, where Allied commandos, British and Canadian commandos, tried to take the port, and they were pushed back very easily by the Germans. They were repelled, and it was a tremendous failure. And so allies had a big problem. The ports, which were now so well defended by the Germans, how could they possibly land their armies and start a Western Front? And so they came up with a tremendous idea, an amazing idea, which was developed by the British engineers. And they said, well, if we're not going to be able to take over a harbor and land our troops in harbors, so we'll develop our own harbors and we'll develop what's called mobile harbors. They were called Mulberry mobile harbors, in which the British engineers developed an ingenious process in which they would take old battleships. They sunk the battleships to be, anyway, those battleships would be sunk. So they were not in very much in order to be able to used in battle. And they would sink them. Those would be the breakwaters. And then they developed these massive concrete blocks, like these big rectangular concrete blocks. And those concrete blocks would be, they would ferry them across the channel, and they would then sink them in order to create the base for the harbor. And then they would put steel bridges on top of the concrete blocks. And that those would be the mobile harbors that they would set up on beaches. And once they were confident that they would be able to and successfully erect these mobile harbors, these Mulberry harbors, they told the Allied generals that they therefore wouldn't need to land on in a harbor, in a port, in a deep water port, but they would be able to land on beaches. And so that made it much easier for the Allies to plan this operation, because they could then choose areas, firstly, that the Germans were not expecting, and secondly, that were not as well fortified and defended as the harbors were defended. And so that opened up the opportunity to now choose a place where they could land their forces. Now, what was critical and vital, and one of the most fascinating parts of D-Day, was the attempts to deceive the Germans. It was critical and vital that the Germans didn't know where the landings would be. Because if they did know, and they were expecting the Allied troop carriers and boats to come in those beaches, if the Germans were waiting for them with their best forces, they certainly would repel the landings, and they would push them back, and they would defeat the attempt to create a bridgehead in Western Europe. And so the Allies put a tremendous amount of effort to deceive the Germans into thinking the landings would be elsewhere, in order that they wouldn't be prepared and waiting for them. The reason is because the Germans, there was a lot of discussion in the German senior ranks amongst their generals, because the head of the army in the West was von Rundstedt, General von Rundstedt. And Hitler, at the end of 1943, appointed his best General Rommel to be in charge of the coastal fortifications. So Rommel and von Rundstedt clashed over where the panzer, there are two divisions of panzer troops in France, which were probably the best troops, arguably the best troops in the world at the time. Maybe the American paratroopers were slightly better, but or the same. But these were very well-trained, experienced, well-equipped panzer troops. And they would have the ability to repel the invasion easily and comfortably. Question is, where should they be? So Rommel felt that that these two divisions of panzers should be near the coast, and therefore they could arrive very quickly once the invasion starts. Von Rundstedt felt they should be further back, and they will be deployed as soon as the landings would take place. But they needed to be in an area where there's good transportation and good access to arrive quickly at the places where the landings would be. So Rommel knew. Rommel was the desert fox. He had fought the Allies in North Africa. And what was critical at this stage of the war was that the German Air Force, the Luftwaffe, was severely weakened, because you had already had the Battle of Britain, and you had had and now the planes, the air force of the Allies was bombing Germany, and their bombing of Germany demanded all of the remaining planes of the Germans to defend the German homeland. So the Luftwaffe didn't have any spare planes to defend the western front, the western coastline, the Atlantic Wall, as they called it. And so Rommel knew that. So he knew since the Allies would dominate the skies, it would be crucial that the two panzer divisions would arrive very quickly at the coast, because if they were delayed, the Allied planes would prevent them from getting there. They would strafe them, they would bomb them as they made their way to the coast where the landings were. And so he wanted them very close. Von Rundstedt disagreed, and Von Rundstedt overruled Rommel. And so the panzer divisions were a little bit further back from the coastline, which was very important and very significant. So what the Allies did in order to deceive the Germans was they had a number of agents which were actually double agents. So the Germans thought they were agents that were providing intel for Germany, but really they were double agents, and they were set up by the Allies. There was an individual in particular who was very central to all of this. His code name was Garbo. That's what the Allied military intelligence called him, Garbo. And he was an individual who was sending information back to Germany. The Germans thought that he was their spy. And he said that he had significant agents working for him in all of the major ports in England, and they were reporting back to him. And in fact, the British gave this individual real valuable intel, which was accurate. So in order to build up his credibility with the Germans, imagine making a decision like that. You're giving the Germans valuable intel, and they could act on it, and as a result, soldiers or sailors would be killed. But the British did that on purpose in order to build up his credibility. And so the Germans saw him as being a valid and reliable source. And he was feeding information to Germany, saying that his agents in the ports in England, particularly the area of Dover, the Dover area, that there was a massive buildup of Allied troops in those areas. And the most logical place for the invasion to be would be in a place called Pas-de-Calais. Pas-de-Calais is the closest point in France from England, from the United Kingdom. So Dover, the port of Dover, to Pas-de-Calais is 42 kilometers away. And so that would therefore be the most logical place for the invasion to be, because the channel was notorious in being a very difficult and rough sea to negotiate. The weather is unpredictable. There are very high waves and very big storms. And so it's very difficult to cross the channel. So it would make sense that the Allies would choose a place where the crossing would be the shortest, which is Pas-de-Calais. And so firstly, it's logical that that's where the crossings would be. Secondly, the Germans are receiving these reports from their agent, Garbo, saying there's a huge buildup of troops in the Calais area, in the Dover area. And the Allies knew that the one general that the Germans respected and were frightened of was George Patton. Patton was he was built in the mold of the German generals. He was rough and he was demanding, and he had very high standards, and he didn't tolerate anybody who didn't do the job 100%. In fact, what had just happened was one of his soldiers had been injured in the battlefront, and Patton went to see him in hospital. And the soldier had PTSD, and he told Patton he can't go back to the front. And Patton slapped him in the hospital. And when this report got to the high command of the Allies, so they were very upset with Patton, and they were very critical of him. And in fact, they sidelined him because of this incident. And so he wasn't going to be a part of the D-Day invasion, and that broke his heart. It really broke him. But they used him to their advantage. And they said that Patton was mobilizing his ninth army in the area of Dover. And in fact, Patton was there and they sent him there with a lot of publicity. And they built a fake army. There was an army that the Allies built, which was made up of blow up tanks and blow up means like you with air. That I've seen pictures of them picking up and holding these blow up tanks and like putting them down. And they had fields and fields of these tanks and of trucks and of jeeps. So it looked like a whole army was building up in that region. So the Germans were receiving the reports from their agent, who was saying that Dover's the area where they're building up a lot of forces. They saw Patton was there, and they sent in their spy planes, and they took pictures, and they saw these fields and fields of these armies of tanks and of trucks and of jeeps. And so they convinced that this is the area. And not only that, the Allies also set up false radio communications as if there was a whole army buildup in that area. It was all a lie. It was all false and fake. But they were sending messages from one to the other all day long saying, we'll move this company here. We'll move this division there. We'll set it up in this way. So the Germans were intercepting those messages and receiving the radio communications. So we see there's a lot of information supporting that the invasion will be at Pas de Calais. And so the Germans are convinced that that's what's going to be. They're hearing the radio waves. They see Patton over there. They have pictures of his army. Their agents are reinforcing this information. So they're convinced that that's where the attack is going to come from, and it'll be at Pas de Calais. So therefore, they make sure that their two divisions of panzers are near Pas de Calais and are ready to mobilize if the invasion comes over there. And they don't expect that the invasion is going to come from the south of England onto the beaches of Normandy, because that's quite a long way away. The distance from Portsmouth, which is the main port in the south, I mean, they used many ports in the south, but the main one was Portsmouth, and that's where Eisenhower was. The distance was 186 kilometers, as opposed to 42 kilometers from Dover to Pas de Calais. So from Portsmouth to Caen, which is the main city in Normandy over there, is 186 km. So it's much, much further to cross the channel over there than it is to do so at Pas de Calais. So the Allies therefore had to make sure that the Germans were not expecting the attack to be in Normandy, in the south of further south. And were all indications were that it was going to be at Pas de Calais. And the Allies were so secretive, because obviously there was a massive troop buildup now, not in central and eastern England, but rather in the south of England, the southern ports. So they were so secretive, the Allies, that they didn't allow the troops to leave their camps. They couldn't go into town. They had to stay exactly where they were. They didn't want there to be a knowledge by the population that there's so many troops over there in the south. And so the troops were locked up for weeks and weeks, which was very hard for them. And they even stopped all diplomatic communication from the United Kingdom to the rest of the world. They didn't allow embassies to communicate with their mother countries because they were so concerned that the information of the troop buildup in the south would get out. So they were very, very careful to make sure that they would deceive the Germans into thinking that the attack would be at Pas de Calais. Please stay with us. We'll be back in a moment.
This is Focus on Our Sages with Rabbi Danny Sackstein on 101.9 High FM.
So we now have Eisenhower, who's planning this tremendous operation. We have the deception that is in full swing to deceive the Germans that the attack is going to be in Pas de Calais. And now Eisenhower has to select a date. When is the invasion going to take place? Now, it was critical that the invasion takes place at low tide, where the sea is calm. Because, as we mentioned, the channel is notorious for rough seas. And what Rommel did So as I mentioned, at the end of 43, Hitler sent Rommel to France and to be in charge of the coastal fortifications. When Rommel arrived, even though there had been a tremendous amount put into these bunkers, into these pull boxes, into the harbors and the general Atlantic wall and protection defense of Fortress Europe for the Nazis, Rommel was not pleased. He was not impressed with what he saw, and he saw there were many, many gaps in the lines. And he therefore put in a tremendous amount of effort to make sure that those gaps were closed and that the entire coastline was very well defended. Of course, the deep water ports, the harbors, as well as the beaches. And so Rommel, he made sure that they built many more bunkers and many more pull boxes, machine gun nests, as well as placing a tremendous amount of obstacles on the beaches in case the Allies wanted to land their crafts over there. And so there were millions of obstacles. There were 3 million bunkers all the way across the Atlantic wall. There were millions of mines. There were millions of these obstacles. Obstacles were something, these things called hedgehogs, which were, they were old railway lines that were taken, and they were made into these shapes like a big X, and most of them were mined. So if a ship then was moving and the bottom of the ship hit this metal piece that was jutting out, and there was a mine there, would blow up the ship, or even if it wasn't mined, it would puncture the ship. So the Allies could only land at low tide. Otherwise, their ships would be punctured or blown up by these obstacles. And also at low tide, it means that the seas had to be calm enough for the thousands and hundreds of thousands of soldiers to disembark from the ships and get into the landing craft. So they were in these big ships, and then they had to get into these landing crafts, which would take them. They were called Higgins boats, developed by somebody from Louisiana in the United States, Higgins, in which they were these like flat, big, rectangular shaped boats that would take the soldiers, the infantry, to the beaches from the big ships. So if it's very rough waters, the soldiers wouldn't be able to get into the landing craft, and the landing craft themselves wouldn't make it to the beaches. They would probably sink, and it would be too difficult for the soldiers to disembark. And you needed low tide for them to see all the obstacles that were in front of them. So there were only a few days a month in which the conditions were suitable for the landings. And the moon had to be in a certain place. There had to be a full moon so they could see at night. And the tides had to be very low. And it had to be the tide had to be coming in, which would suit the invasion. So the dates in which that was suitable, originally they told Stalin in November 43 that the invasion would be May 44, but they weren't ready for May. So then they chose the dates in June were either 4th, 5th, 6th, or 7th of June were suitable for the landings. And so Eisenhower chose the 5th of June. On the morning of the 4th of June, every day Eisenhower got, a few times a day actually, he got briefings from the meteorologists of the Allies. There was somebody by the name of Captain Stagg, who was the best meteorologist in the United Kingdom. And he was very skilled at working out, predicting what the weather would be in the channel. The reason is that they had most of the weather came from northwest, which was from Iceland, from Greenland. And he was able to pretty accurately predict what the weather would be, you know, for the next 2 or 3 days. And on the morning of the 4th of June, which was the day before the invasion, it's very calm. There's no storms. There's no wind. He comes into the briefing room at 6 o'clock in the morning in Portsmouth, where the Chaif headquarters was. So there's Eisenhower and all the top generals of the Allies. And he says to them, "I have bad news." He said, "There's a massive storm on its way, and they're going to be very strong winds and very high waves. There's no way we're going to be able to carry out the invasion tomorrow." So it was due for the next day, for the 5th of June. And therefore, we have to postpone the invasion. And so Eisenhower had been working with him for a while. He knew that this guy knew what he was talking about, had a lot of credibility. So he says, "Okay, we have no choice, but we have to go." So can you imagine such a thing? The logistical operation, I mean, the scale of D-Day was just unbelievable. There were when Eisenhower first arrived in England, in he arrived in January 44. So there was already a plan that had been drawn up for the invasion. And he and Montgomery felt that that plan was too small. It was not, the scale wasn't large enough. That original plan was only, there were two divisions that were set aside for, sorry, three divisions, which were set aside with a 35-mile front. And Eisenhower and Montgomery increased it to five divisions, which is 150,000 men, and a 50-mile wide front. So can you imagine such a thing, the transportation of 150,000 men? There were more than 7,000 ships or craft that had to be involved in that transportation. And there were more than 11,000 planes, 23,000 paratroopers, 130,000 soldiers would be landing on the beaches. It's just the scale of it is breathtaking. And now they get this information that they have to delay it, which is many of the ships had already left. Many of the soldiers had already embarked the ships and were waiting to leave. And they have to delay and postpone for 24 hours, which was a big blow to them. And so they have no choice. They postpone it. The next day, on June the 5th, when the invasion was supposed to be, they met at 4 in the morning, the briefing in the headquarters. And Captain Stagg is there, the meteorologist once more is there. And Eisenhower says that he's never seen winds like that in his life. He said the building, the house that they were in, was actually shaking from the winds. The storm was extremely severe. And he said, thankfully, they listened and they had postponed the invasion. Many of the troops were actually on ships through the storm. Even though they were in harbor, you know, it was just terrible for them. They got very seasick. And Stagg said, I have good news, that we're expecting the next couple of days to be stormy, but there's going to be a lull in 24 hours. There's going to be, not in 24, he said there's going to be a lull starting soon for 24 to 36 hours. And so it would be, the storm will calm sufficiently for us to be able to land our troops. And so he said, that's my estimate, that's my prediction. And so they all cross-examined him, and then they turned to Eisenhower, who had to make the decision. So can you, and that's part of what we mentioned earlier, that to have one commander would be the person who would take responsibility and make decisions. If you've got too many chiefs, so no decisions are made. You know, it's like a shul committee that nobody makes any decisions, everybody just complains. But if there's one person who's got responsibility, one CEO who runs the show, that he is positioned to make the critical decisions and to ensure that, you know, things are run in a successful way. So the many of the books, I've read many books and heard many interviews. So a lot of them all say that Eisenhower, he stopped and he pondered for 5 minutes and then he responded. But Eisenhower himself says, no, that's an exaggeration. It's not true. He said that he was, he thought about it for about 45 seconds. And he considered the risks of delaying. And every moment they delayed, word could get out that the invasions were coming to Normandy and not past the Calais. And he said he thought about those risks against the risks of going ahead with the invasion, considering the weather. And he said he decided that the risk of going was less than the risk of delaying. And he said, it's a go. And as he put his hand on the table, he said, it's a go. He said, by the time he had lifted, he said the room was clear. Like all of these generals had to now go and get the show on the road. He said they all just scattered and left the room, and off they went. And so it was a go, and scheduled for the 6th of June, 1944. Please stay with us. We'll be back in a moment.
This is Focus on Our Sages with Rabbi Danny Sackstein on 101.9 Chai FM.
We're talking about D-Day and the 80th anniversary this year of the incredible events of D-Day, which was the largest amphibious invasion in the history of the world. As I mentioned, 7,000 ships, 130,000 soldiers landed on D-Day on the five beaches. There were 11,000 planes involved, 23,000 paratroopers were dropped behind enemy lines. just an incredible operation carried out by the Allies. And so Eisenhower gives the go-ahead, gives the green light, and off they go. And the invasion was meant to be, so there was something called the transportation plan, which the Air Force of the Allies had been bombing France and the French transportation lines for many, many weeks in order to make sure that it would be, communications would be knocked out and transportation would be severely limited, because they didn't want the German reinforcements to be able to get to the beaches on time to push back the invasion. And that was very successful. But the bombings on the night before, so the night before, there were massive bombings to try and soften up the German defenses on the coastline. There was a very cloudy night, the night of the 6th of June. And so most of those bombers missed their targets. And likewise, the big ships opened up their big guns at about 4 in the morning before the troops went forward to land. Also, they missed most of their targets because there was a huge cloud bank. So by the time the soldiers had to get into the landing craft and land on the beaches, the German positions were pretty much in place and untouched. And so some of the beaches, there were 5 beaches. 3 of them were the Sword Beach, which was British soldiers. Juno was Canadian. Gold was British. Omaha, American, and Utah, American. And these 5 beaches, some of them were very well fortified, some weren't so well fortified. So the landings were, the beach of Omaha was the best defended by the Germans. And the first hours of landings were absolute mayhem for the Allies. They lost over 1,000 soldiers in the first few hours, and they struggled to create a beachhead. It was very, very difficult for them, but eventually they succeeded through great bravery and through the ingenuity and creativity of the soldiers, of the GIs on the beach. They were able to establish some sort of a beachhead over there in Omaha, and they moved forward and were able to attack the German positions from behind and destroy them, and so too with the other beaches. And so all in all, the landings were a tremendous success. 130,000 soldiers of the Allies landed on D-Day on 6th of June 1944, and they expected, the experts of the army said to Eisenhower that they expected an attrition rate of 70% on D-Day. They thought that 7 out of 10 soldiers that would land on those beaches would be killed, but it was far less than that. It was only 1 out of 10, which is still, it's a big number. Over 10,000 died on D-Day, but it was a lot less than they expected. And the landings were a great success, and they created this beachhead. And 10 weeks later, the Allies were in Paris, and they had defeated the Germans in France, and now they moved straight to Germany. And less than a year later, the Nazis were defeated. So the events of D-Day were tremendously significant in World War II, and the victory of the Allies undoubtedly came from the success of D-Day. And if it weren't for the unbelievable bravery of so many of these soldiers and the excellent planning of their generals, so the Nazis maybe would not have lost the war. And if the Nazis didn't lose the war, the world would have been very, very different. Certainly many more thousands of Jews, hundreds of thousands of Jews, or millions of Jews would have been killed. And the world would have been continued to be under the grip of this thousand-year Reich of the tyranny of the Nazis. So we see that D-Day was a great success, and something we should be very grateful for, the sacrifice of these soldiers and for the bravery of the Allies and for the defeat of the Nazis. And please God, the world should learn its lessons, and we should never have to go through such things again. Thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful day.